Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about AIDS. In 2007, it's estimated that more than 33 million people around the world lived with the disease, and it killed an estimated 2.1 million people, including 330,000 children. Every day around the world, 12,000 people will contract AIDS, and that is in spite of the fact that we know very well how it is spread and how it can be prevented. In this first hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with journalist and epidemiologist Elizabeth Pisani, and she is the author of a book with a very strong title. The Wisdom of Whores is the title of her book. The subtitle, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. The book is published by W.W. Norton. And in this book, she makes the argument that our failure to come to grips with AIDS reflects a couple of things. It reflects our discomfort with the fact that it is a sexually transmitted disease, and also with the fact that people's desire for sex can sometimes win out over their common sense. She's joining us this morning by telephone, and we'll be happy to take your comments and questions. She has a PhD in infectious disease epidemiology. She has provided research, analysis, and policy advice to a number of organizations, including the United Nations, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, and the Centers for Disease Control. Also, the Ministries of Health of China, Indonesia, East Timor, and the Philippines. And again, she's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief so that we can keep moving along. But anyone's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Pisani, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
Just again, I guess to start with your most basic point, you feel that in spite of everything else that we have done, that we have not made the effort that we should, not put as much resources as we should into prevention.
That's right. Not necessarily even not put enough resources into prevention, but not put enough resources into effective prevention. We're spending plenty of money. We're just not necessarily spending it in the right places and in the right ways.
Well, then, talk a little bit about the things that, and again, staying with prevention, those things that we are doing that you feel that maybe not necessarily you'd say that we shouldn't be doing that, but those things that we are doing that aren't effective, and then we can move on to talking about those things that perhaps would be more effective that you would say that we should be doing.
Well, one of the things that is not particularly effective is to deny the fact that HIV is about sex and it's about drugs. That's the truth of it, and any program that doesn't deal directly with that is not going to be very effective. So one of the things that we do is to avoid talking about sex and drugs. We say, oh, well, HIV is a problem of poverty. It's a problem of gender inequalities. It's a problem of migration and this, that, and the other. And we have programs that try to deal with that, so income generation for women and this sort of thing. And it doesn't deal directly with the things that are spreading HIV. So this whole everyone is at risk and we need to be solving all the problems of the world in order to solve HIV is one of the things that's sucking money away from doing what does need to be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, just stay with that for a moment, because I imagine that some people would react to your assertion that, you know, what we said is that what AIDS is really all about, it's about poverty, it's about lack of education, it's about women's rights or lack of women's rights and so forth. And you're saying, well, that's really not it. I would expect some people could point to places where rates of HIV were very high, and they would say, but look at this place, country X. And you can...
Let's talk countries.
Okay.
So within sub-Saharan Africa... I should be clear about something first. There are two separate HIV epidemics in the world. One of them is in eastern southern Africa, some would say all of sub-Saharan Africa, and it's an epidemic that is spread by sexual behavior between men and women in the general population. in all of the rest of the world, from the United States to China, from Indonesia to Kyrgyzstan to France, HIV is spread very largely by a small number of behaviors which are practiced by a minority of the population, and those are commercial sex, so people selling sex and people buying it. They are sex between men who have multiple partners, and their drug injection. So that's the second epidemic. Let's stay for a minute on the first epidemic, the sub-Saharan African epidemic. HIV is highest in the richest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, Botswana, Zambia, Zimbabwe. HIV is highest in the richest households in any given sub-Saharan African country. HIV is higher among more educated women than among less educated women, and the same for men. So it's too easy just to say it's associated with poverty. In fact, within the context of an already very poor continent, it appears to be associated, in fact, with wealth.
Then, if that is the case, and we're talking about these two different kinds of epidemics, and we can talk about them separately, and because they are different, that would suggest then your approach to dealing with the spread of HIV should be different. In this particular case, then, what really do you think is driving, if we just talk about Eastern and Southern Africa, what is driving the epidemic there?
It's patterns of sexual behavior, and this is one of the things that it has been hampering us dealing with it effectively, is that no one has wanted to be very clear that patterns of sexual behavior tend to differ in East and Southern Africa than they do in much of the rest of the world, partly because of a history of polygamy. But the truth is that people in East and Southern Africa, both men and women, are more likely than people in much of the rest of the world to have a small number of sexual partners simultaneously. So it's quite possible that they will have fewer sexual partners over the course of their lifetime than someone in the United States would, or France, or Britain. But they're more likely to have more than one partner at any given time. And because of the way the HIV virus works, it favors people who have simultaneous multiple partnerships. And let me explain why. HIV is actually not very infectious. For most of the time, it's not a very infectious virus. It's very, very infectious when you very first become infected. And that period of highly infectious disease lasts about between 3 and 6 months. And then you start making antibodies, and your body brings it under control. It never quite goes away, but it trots along at very low levels for a very long time. And at that stage, it's much more difficult to pass on. So if you have more than one partner in any given 3 month period, you're more likely to pass it on to someone else just shortly after you become infected. If you only change partners once every 6 months or once a year, you could clock up more partners overall, but you're less likely to pass on HIV because by the time you move on to your next partner, you're no longer very infectious. So that's really the thing that makes the big difference between what's happening in sub-Saharan Africa and the rest of the world. But we've been very reluctant to talk about it because the minute you talk about anything like that, people say, oh, you're being racist. And of course, my point of view about that would be, how is it racist to say that people have people's patterns of sexual behavior differ? It's just a fact. It's neither a good fact nor a bad fact. It's just a fact.
Mm. Well, given if that is what is going on, and if the issue is much more that rather than having many partners, the issue is that actually having fewer partners, but having them for longer periods of time. So being married and maybe then having one or two long-term outside relationships, that is actually a more that will end up more effectively transmitting the virus and infecting people than having one sexual partner for a year, and then having another sexual partner for a year, and then having another sexual partner for a year.
Exactly, which is more the type of behavior that we tend to have in Western countries, also in Latin America and in Asia.
And then if what we have done in terms of our of the education that we're doing, if we've warned people about that, if we've said, you know, warned people about having a lot of sexual partners, then what we're doing is, at least in this particular case, then we're warning people about the wrong thing.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
And that perhaps also people think if they, maybe if they just have two partners or three partners, they're going to think, and that they're steady, that that's a steady relationship, that they think that that's going to protect them. And that's not the risky behavior. The risky behavior is the cross-country truck driver who has sex with prostitutes in every city he travels through, which is certainly problematic. But if that's the message that people are getting, then, as I said, then that's you're not targeting the behaviors that are really problematic.
That's right. And, of course, one of the things that people take on board is, oh, well, if it's a regular partner, I don't need to use condoms because, it's only with irregular partners that you need to be using condoms. And so you get people who are in these multiple, the pompous word for it is multiple concurrent partnerships, who are having these two or three steady partners at any one time, thinking that, that's a safe partnership and therefore condom use in those partnerships isn't necessary. And so we've been reinforcing with our messages that focus on high-risk sexual encounters, non-regular partners. We've been reinforcing that message that you don't need to worry about your regular partnerships, and that's actually where most transmission is happening in some countries.
Hmm. So if in this particular case, then, if we did nothing else, if we didn't try to persuade people to have a different pattern of sexual activity, however, we could get them to use condoms every time that they had intercourse, how much difference would that make?
It would make all the difference in the world. It would make all the difference in the world. It would essentially wipe out the epidemic. But we have to be realistic. Most people prefer sex without a condom to sex with a condom, particularly in these intimate, regular relationships. That we need to be realistic about how possible that is to achieve. I think we could achieve a lot more than we currently do, but we also need to be persuading people to actually reduce the number of partnerships, and we need to be treating HIV like an infectious disease. So instead of having our programs focused on poverty and this and that, we need to be doing the sorts of things that we do for other infectious diseases, which is, if someone comes in and is diagnosed with infection, asking them who their sex partners are, asking them to refer their sex partners for testing and for treatment if necessary. And that's something that's been difficult to do for reasons of, I guess you could say, political correctness, because the history of the epidemic was, first recognized very much among gay men in this country. It was a highly, highly stigmatized disease. If you tested positive, you were going to lose your job, lose your friends, lose your health insurance, and very soon after that, lose your life. And there was nothing positive we could do for you. That was true in 1986. It's no longer true today, but we've still got this reluctance to promote testing because of the fear of stigma. And we need to get over that, and we need to do a lot more of that, particularly in countries in East and Southern Africa where HIV is widespread through the general population.
But I think what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that that's not just a problem in Africa, that the issue of perhaps not enough people being tested, or when someone tests positive, then doing contact tracing, that we really don't, sounds as if we really don't do that anyplace.
No, you're right. We ought to be doing it everywhere. The difference is that in most of the world, we need effectively to be targeting our testing and contact tracing in the populations that are most at risk, not across the population as a whole. I don't know if you read, I'm here in New York right now, and the Bronx, just two or three days ago, the borough of the New York borough of the Bronx announced that they were going to try and test every adult in the Bronx for HIV over a 3-year period. From a financial point of view, that means performing an awful lot of tests on people who are actually not going to be at any risk for HIV, and we know it, just so that we can increase testing among those who are most at risk.
Well, I suppose that maybe also points to something else that I certainly want to have you talk about, and that is the idea that early on in the epidemic, when it became obvious just how serious a problem this was, that people who were activists around the issue of AIDS, and I suppose also people who were policy people as well, said that we sort of said that we need to people need to understand how serious this is, that it is serious, because if we don't acknowledge that, then we're not going to make a serious effort at trying to fight the disease. And that the best way perhaps to do that would be to try to persuade everybody, to put the message out there that everybody is at risk. No matter who you are, everybody is at risk. So if you get everybody's attention, then you get support for dealing with the problem. Huh. You seem to be making the argument that, in fact, it wasn't right that there are lots and lots of people who was risk of AIDS, of getting HIV and AIDS, are quite low as to almost be zero. Why was that, do you think, the wrong thing to do, to put out that message that says to people, everybody is at risk?
I don't think it was the wrong thing to do if we then used that as cover to do effective prevention for the people that are most at risk. You know, so in the book I describe it as a poker game, public health as being a bit of a poker game. Don't know if you're a poker player, but I'm sure some of your listeners are. You know, and in poker what you do is you throw away money on some hands that you know you're going to lose, so that when you get the really good cards, you can bluff your way into winning. And in a way, that's what we do in public health. So we sacrifice some money on these general population programs to make everyone feel concerned about AIDS so that there's sufficient concern that we can get on and do programs for the groups that are not particularly politically popular, the drug injectors, the gay men, the sex workers. We can get on and do programs for them and get away with it. But And I still think that that's not a bad strategy. The problem is that we were so good at making it everyone is at risk that, in fact, we then didn't get on and do the programs for the people who are most at risk in lots of countries. So that's partly because of institutional incentives. So a lot of organizations, non-government organizations, non-profits, but also United Nations organizations, who have no interest in doing any work around sex or around drugs, were like, oh, great, HIV is everyone's problem. Now we can get money to deal with HIV. And as the pot of funding for HIV grew, there were more and more people who were interested in working in the HIV field, as long as they didn't have to do any of that icky stuff around sex and drugs. So by making it everyone's problem, now you can get funding for HIV and agriculture, HIV and school programs, HIV and fisheries, HIV and global warming, whatever it is, and not confining that money to HIV and sex and HIV and drugs. So to summarize, it's okay to raise public concern and make people feel that this is something that they ought to be concerned about, if we then use that as cover to do what needs to be done. But it's not okay to do that as an alternative to doing what needs to be done.
Well, that's one brief quote I wrote down here that I think is very striking in a sense, encapsulates that, is that at one point you write in the book that there are basically two things that have really gotten in the way of dealing with AIDS, ideology and money, and you write, in the AIDS industry, we have too much of both.
That's right. I don't think anyone would dispute the first of those statements. A lot of people are actively disputing the second of those statements. And, you know, could we do better with less money than we already have? Certainly on prevention, we could. Treatment, unfortunately, is an expensive thing, and we need even more money probably than is currently available. But on prevention, I do think that an abundance of money has removed the incentive and the need to use the money that we have in the most effective ways.
We are getting very close already to our midpoint of this conversation in this first hour of Focus 580, and I would like to again to introduce our guest, Elizabeth Pisani. She has a PhD in infectious disease epidemiology. She has done research and analysis and policy advice for the United Nations, World Health Organization, World Bank, Centers for Disease Control, also the Ministries of Health of China, Indonesia, East Timor, and the Philippines. She's the author of the book The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. It's published by W.W. Norton, and as she has been explaining here, she makes the argument that one of the reasons that we have not come to grips with AIDS is that we have really failed in dealing with prevention and doing enough prevention, and that that has a lot to do with the fact that AIDS is a sexually transmitted disease, and we're not real comfortable in talking about sex and talking with people about their sexual behaviors. Questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me ask you about you talked about the fact that there are really two epidemics. One is that we see in Eastern and Southern Africa. The other is really what's going on in the rest of the world, where the serious issues are commercial sex, men who have sex with other men, and people who inject drugs. The title of the book maybe would suggest that you think that people who work in the sex industry maybe know something that people who work on AIDS policy don't.
Well, actually, the title of the book is sort of a bit of a joke in many ways. It certainly suggests that I've learned an awful lot from the people that I've worked with in the field who are sex workers and drug injectors and whatever. And actually, funnily enough, I even learned a lot about how to do my job as an epidemiologist. So I, waltzed into the field with my PhD in infectious disease epidemiology and with my my guidebooks on how to do great research among sex workers, which I myself had written on behalf of the World Health Organization before I ever spoke to a sex worker. And I waltzed into the field with these things. And then I found myself thinking, hang on, it doesn't work like this. And I remember one very funny evening. I was at my house with a stunningly beautiful transgender sex worker called Ines. And she was over because I was trying to get her cast in a film that was being produced by a friend, and I wanted to introduce her to this friend. And she was knocking back my very delicious but extremely expensive single malt whiskey, scotch. And I was like, I said, boy, you've got expensive taste, for someone with three clients a week. And she said to me, what do you mean three clients a week? And I said, well, we've just done this research and we've asked a representative sample of all the transgender sex workers in Jakarta, and the average number of clients is three. And she said, well, that's because you're talking to all the wrong people. You're doing your surveys wrong. And I thought, okay, here's a grade school dropout sex worker telling me that I don't know how to do my job. So I said, well, let me explain why we do it the way we do it. We have a random sample, blah, 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 blah. And she said to me, you're not listening to me. You're doing your surveys all wrong. You've got your methods wrong. You're talking to all the dogs. And I said, no, you're not listening to me. I explain again. And she said, the thing is that if someone is talking to if a sex worker is talking to a member of a research team, it's because they're not with a client. So, of course, you're getting the ones who report very few clients because you're talking to all the ugly ones who are left on the streets with no clients. They're the ones who are talking to you. And I thought, oh, yeah, she's absolutely right. And, in fact, we've changed even the WHO guidelines in the light of what I learned from Ines, the transgender sex worker. So I learned a lot from the sex workers I worked with, both about how to do my job, about how they do theirs, and about how we can help them do theirs more safely. But the other part of the title is that also, as I said, we've got too much money in the business now. All kinds of people who are not interested in dealing with sex and drugs are in the business because they're going for the money. So in the AIDS business, there are an awful lot of people who are selling themselves to the highest bidder. So I guess in a way we're all whores. Mm.
Just to stay with the idea or with the subject of sex workers, it would seem that on the face of it that here again, if you could persuade them to make sure that their clients always used condoms and then perhaps also institute some kind of periodic testing for sex workers, so that then if people did become infected, then they could at the very least could get into treatment, that would go some way to trying to limit the spread of the disease that way. At the same time, saying those things are one thing and having them happen to something else. Would that, in fact, be the approach if you were trying to limit the spread through the sales of sex?
Oh, absolutely. And it's an approach that has worked in every country that's tried it on any scale. Thailand essentially shut down its epidemic, its heterosexual epidemic, by instituting something called the 100% Condom Use Program, working with brothel owners. So they were essentially blackmailing brothel owners into making sure that every transaction in any given brothel used a condom. And the penalty was that the brothel would get shut down. If a girl became infected with a sexually transmitted infection, it was evidence that they weren't using condoms in that brothel, and they could shut the brothel down. So essentially they were hitting the brothel owner where it hurts most, which is in the wallet. And that was very, very effective. Screening and treatment of sex workers has been very effective in a number of countries, including the Philippines. And it's been effective in Western countries and in some African countries, too. The reason that we're not doing more of it is because there's a political resistance to it, not least from the government of the United States of America, which has this extraordinarily generous HIV program for other countries, which forbids us to work effectively with sex workers.
And that is why, because we somehow think that rather than getting people to practice safe sex, we can somehow get them not to have sex at all?
Apparently so. If ever there was an example of ideology trumping the facts, I would say that is it. There's a big lobby in parts of that has a very wide voice loud voice in the White House right now, that seeks to abolish sex work. And in fact, the U.S. program for HIV overseas, which is known as PEPFAR, actually says we will work to eradicate prostitution. You know, there are sex workers in the Bible. There have been sex workers before that, and there have been sex workers ever since. So it seems to me that it's unlikely that abolishing it is going to be an effective solution.
Just thinking about what you were talking about, how what they did in Thailand was to really put pressure on the people who ran brothels to get them to make sure that their workers were using condoms and that were submitting to testing and so forth, that they leaned on them fairly hard, or at least in the sense that either if you don't do this, then we'll put you out of business. Is it possible for this to work in a way that's not coercive, or does there have to be some kind of coercion, even, you know, if it's on the mild side, to get that to work?
I wouldn't call it coercion. I would call it incentive. I mean, I think that public health, I say somewhere in the book, I think, is essentially rather a fascist discipline in a way. You are, in infectious disease control, you very often restrict the rights of a small number of individuals in order to protect the health of the majority. And we do it with other infectious diseases all the time. So you remember the big SARS scare, and suddenly everyone who was flying an aeroplane was wearing masks, and they shut down the whole of the capital of the world's largest nation, Beijing, for 11 days. No one was allowed to go in or out. We do it with avian flu. We even do contact tracing with syphilis. But we don't do it for HIV because we're scared of the stigma associated with it, and et cetera, et cetera. But I think we need to do more. We need to start being much more traditional in the way that we approach this disease.
And I suppose when it comes to dealing with people who are drug injectors and limiting the spread of the disease there, you would say essentially the arguments here parallel the one that we've been making for sex, and that is that what would make most sense would be to provide people with clean needles, but that we're not going to do that because what we really think we should be doing is trying to keep people from injecting drugs at all.
That's right. But, you know, I find it very extraordinary that we make an argument for treating people, treating people's HIV infection on the basis of compassion. You know, this person is sick and therefore we need to give them expensive medication for the rest of their life, but we can't bring ourselves to use the same compassionate argument to stop them getting sick in the first place by saying this person is an addict, we need to give them clean needles so that they don't become infected. I think one thing is that people don't understand very well the nature of addiction, and that people tend to progress through it. It tends to be particularly heroin addiction, which is a cause of most HIV infections in drug injectors. It tends to be something that you grow out of. And yet, do I think it's a great idea to stick toxic substances into your veins 3 times a day? Absolutely not. Does it wreck your life and the life of the family and friends who support you? Well, yeah, it does. But most people are going to get over it, particularly if they're kept in a health system that constantly refers them for treatment, for addiction treatment. And we need to be helping people to get through that phase in their life in a way that doesn't have them emerging with a fatal disease.
Our guest, again, in this part of Focus 580 is Elizabeth Bazzani. Her book is The Wisdom of Horace, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. The book is published by W.W. Norton. She has worked as a journalist and also consultant on this issue for a number of different organizations, including the World Health Organization and the UN and the CDC. She has a PhD in infectious disease epidemiology, and questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I think that probably some people would say that one of the greatest advances here in dealing with the spread of AIDS and the life that people who are HIV positive can have is the availability of antiretroviral drugs, which makes it possible for people who are HIV positive to live and at least have a relatively healthy, relatively normal life for some period of time, certainly more than before those drugs became available. But in the book, you make the argument that there mightn't be, in fact, be one way that's been counterproductive, at least in the sense that people maybe aren't as afraid of the disease as they once were. And maybe individuals are not thinking as much about prevention as they had been as a result.
I think that unfortunately all the evidence points that way. Of course, the minute you say something like this, everyone says, "Oh my God, you're just you're anti-treatment. You want to let everyone die?" Absolutely not. Treatment is the, as you say, the great success story of this epidemic. And it's absolutely fantastic that we're managing now to begin to provide treatment on a substantial scale to people even in the poorest countries. It's absolutely fantastic. But the evidence from the rich countries is that the increase of treatment also increases new infections. Certainly, it increases the absolute size of the epidemic if you're doing your treatment well, simply because people don't die as fast. So that means people live longer, and therefore there are more people living with HIV at any given time. I mean, that's just arithmetic. The question is, does an increase in treatment also increase the likelihood that you will have more new infections? Some people believe that that's not the case, because treatment actually brings down the amount of virus in your blood and therefore makes it less likely that you will pass on HIV infection. That's certainly true. But, as I said before, if you remember, that people are most infectious right when they're very, very first infected. That's where a lot of transmission is going on. And those people are not on treatment. And so treatment doesn't affect the likelihood that they'll be passing on the virus. Now, if treatment does have the effect of making it less scary, does have the effect of people not really caring that much or being that diligent about using condoms, maybe allows them to have sex with someone they wouldn't otherwise have had sex with because, oh, well, I'm not so scared anymore, then there's a greater likelihood that people will have sex with someone who's newly infected, not on treatment, as highly infectious. And all the information that we have, which comes from, so far, the United States, the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, and the Netherlands, all point in the direction of the fact that, at least among gay men, the population where we've got most data, treatment, an increase in treatment is leading to an increase in new infections. Mm. It's very worrisome.
That and it seems that surprising, at least in the sense that it seems that within the gay community, at least initially, there was a very determined effort to educate people, to change people's behavior, to really deal with this. And it seemed that, at least initially, that was quite successful.
It was very successful indeed. I do think that, in part, it's this slacking, if you want, on prevention is a response of people in the most affected communities not being so scared anymore and therefore not being so diligent about protecting themselves. But I do think it's also in part because the AIDS industry has been focusing so much on increasing access to treatment that we've actually rather dropped the ball on prevention. There's a lot of demand for treatment. You get a lot of political brownie points for great treatment, but you get very few political plus points for giving out clean needles to injectors. And so governments, both in rich countries that are giving funding for HIV prevention and in poor countries that are deciding what to do with that funding, are more keen to focus on treatment than they are to focus on prevention.
Mm. Well, so the problem with something like a needle exchange, though, that we seem to be running up against is the feeling of governments and maybe some people that by doing that we are aiding and abetting an illegal activity that we don't want people doing. We'd rather that they not do it, and somehow we can't get around the idea that giving people a clean needle, while that may spread, that may reduce the spread of HIV, is also somehow facilitating the use of injection drugs.
I have been in this business for 15 years. I have talked to an awful lot of drug injectors, also of people in the sex trade, and I have never had anyone say, oh, look, there's a clean needle. Let me go and start shooting up smack. It doesn't work like that. You are facilitating someone to do something that they're already doing, which is, we agree, a dumb thing to do and a dangerous thing to do. We're facilitating them doing it more safely. That's all. But you're not encouraging people to do it. I mean, saying that you're going to encourage young people to have sex by giving out condoms is like saying you can end a drought by giving out umbrellas. It doesn't work like that. It's not the availability of a commodity that makes a behavior happen. It does make it more likely that if that behavior is going to happen, it's going to happen more safely. But there is no evidence from anywhere in the world, from any point in this epidemic or preceding it, that giving out prevention services increases the behaviors that put people at risk for HIV.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, I guess it then gets us back to this basic problem of perhaps coming to accept the fact that people are going to do things because they want to do them. Now, if you're addicted to heroin, that you're not maybe going to have a lot of choice, particularly if there are not good opportunities for you to get help to get off that drug. Sex is, I suppose, something else, but it's a strong drive, and people are going to want to do it, and they're going to do it. And it's somehow we can't quite, again, get used to the idea that people are going to do what they want to do, maybe sometimes against their better judgment, but that basic drives are kind of what they are, and that we have to deal with that, and we don't seem to be able to.
Well, it's one of the great design successes of human beings, that the thing that allows us to reproduce and increase as a species is one of the most fun things in our repertoire as human beings. We have sex because we like it, because it's fun, and that's what makes us successful as a species. And denying that doesn't seem to be useful to me. I don't know. Do you have any idea why it is that we can't reconcile those things?
Haven't the slightest, other than maybe it's always been, there's some little bit of discomfort attached to the idea that it just is fun. And that people do it just because it feels good. And as you say, I think the point's well taken that if somehow the feel good wasn't built into it, we wouldn't do it. And if we didn't do it, we wouldn't be here, because human beings aren't programmed to do it. You got to find another way to get them to do it. And to apparently the way that nature found was to make it feel good. But no, I don't know. I don't know why it is we can't just quite accept the notion that, yeah, people are going to do it not just to make babies, but because it feels good.
Exactly. I think those things are very intimately tied up, and it's difficult for us to disentangle them. But certainly the evidence suggests that, yeah, most people do it because it's fun. And I think that this is one of the things that is at the bottom of the failure of many of our programs. I think one of my favorite things in my book is actually the footnotes. People tend to skip the footnotes, but for anyone who wants to read it, all the good jokes are in the footnotes. But there was one that when I was trying to explain this to myself, and I was looking at the abstinence-only campaign in the United States, which, as you know, has dedicated an awful lot of money to programs that appear to have absolutely no beneficial effect whatsoever. But I was looking at some of the websites that promote this, and one of them lists 101 things to do besides having sex. Now, I think they mean instead of having sex, but let's not let grammar get in the way of anything. 101 things to do besides having sex. Number two was go to the mall with your friends, and then later on there was talk on the phone, make a scrapbook, visit a nursing home. And I'm sitting there thinking, have an orgasm or visit a nursing home? Now let me see. I mean, if you're giving messages like that to teenagers whose hormones are raging because of the way human beings are designed biologically, you may find that you don't get very far.
Now, you have been critical of the in one way of what the United States has done in terms of trying to put some money into fighting AIDS in the developing world, in Africa in particular. And it seems to me that I think, though, that some people have said, you know, they might say that they disagree with a lot of things this administration has done, but they might say, well, in fact, actually, this is one thing where they've done something good. Would you disagree with that?
No, I absolutely wouldn't disagree. I think that what they have done on treatment and on facilitating access to treatment for people in Africa has been absolutely extraordinary. And I'll be absolutely honest with you, as recently as 2001, I was sitting in Geneva at the World Health Organization, and we were coming up with estimates for what it would cost to beat this epidemic. And we had this big discussion about whether we should put estimates for treating people with HIV in Africa in the numbers or not. And I was like, are you crazy? It's not going to happen. You know, let's stay realistic. Don't be daft. And, you know, it's a mark of great, I have great admiration for the Bush administration for saying, why can't we do this? We're putting it on the agenda. They upped the ante for the rest of the world, and it's now being done. That's great. So on the treatment side, I have nothing but admiration. On the prevention side, unfortunately, I think the U.S. position has been very, I can't even say mixed, actually. It's been harmful because it has taken really essentially a moralistic approach. So a third of all prevention funding had to go to abstinence-only programs in Africa, even though they've been demonstrated to fail in the United States. We're not allowed to spend any money on clean needles for injectors anywhere in the world. We're not allowed to spend money working effectively with sex workers to reduce transmission in commercial sex. So I think on the prevention side, maybe they're two sides of the same coin. The same moral impetus to save lives once someone has become infected comes with a morality that somehow prevents people from doing what needs to be done to prevent a sexually transmitted infection.
We have just about 5 minutes left in the program. We have a couple of callers, so I'll try to get them in the time that remains. We'll start out here with someone in Indiana and our line one. Hello.
Yes, I've certainly enjoyed your conversation and the frankness that you have given. I'm a member of the Indiana Senate, and I recognize fully the problem that you're talking about members of legislatures and of Congress recognizing that people do have sex And instead of addressing it with a common sense approach, they try to do it with a moralistic approach that just obviously is never going to work. I'm wondering if you have in your work found effective ways of getting legislatures to recognize this and take the steps. As an example, do you feel that it would be a positive step if some of the states would in fact legalize prostitution or legalize the sex trade, as you refer to it, and whether or not requiring testing and licensing would be an effective way to address the spread of AIDS? Now I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Well, thank you for the call.
Thank you. That's a very interesting question. I just look at the evidence from countries that have legalized prostitution or have dealt with it in ways that require licensing and regular testing and screening, that provide services for sex workers and require them to use them. And I see that those are among the countries that have the most successful responses to HIV. So the evidence suggests, we're talking about Australia, we're talking about, and there are a number of countries that have. Brazil is a good example. In fact, Brazil turned down $40 million of funding from the United States because the funding came with a string attached that required them to work against the sex trade, and the Brazilian government said, no, we recognize that the sex trade has a right to exist, and we need to try and make it exist more safely. Those are the countries that have done well. So the evidence suggests that, yes, a legal, regulated sex industry does, in fact, lead to certainly less disease transmission and certainly better working conditions for sex workers. Yeah.
All right. I thank the call. Let's go to another call here. This is Nioga and in line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was fascinated by your comments about people are going to have sex and because it's very pleasurable. I think one of the hang-ups with the condom is the fact that it's not quite as pleasurable as not using a condom. So if you could develop a condom that makes it more pleasurable than not using a condom, then I think we'd have the extremely very successful prevention of disease and early childhood developments. But I totally agree with you, but it comes down to the ultimate pleasure with or without. So I'd like to hear your comments.
Well, you know, I have to say you are so right. And there have been an awful lot of effort put into condom design. There are a number of different designs which are trying to increase pleasure. Some are just gimmicky. We've got different flavors. I've been wandering around handing out chocolate-flavored condoms to people in the last couple of weeks, and they seem to go down quite well. Condoms with vibrating top rings to increase pleasure to both partners. But I do think that there is one of the biggest difficulties in promoting condom use in regular partnerships is that it is a barrier to intimacy. And I think that people have a very, very difficult time maintaining condom use in their most regular partnerships because they do reduce intimacy. And it's a psychological thing as much as anything else. It's something that I find very, very frequently in my conversations with women who sell sex for a living. And they say, you know, they're absolutely diligent about using condoms with all of their clients, but they don't use condoms with their boyfriends because, you know, that's the way that you distinguish between your work life and your private life. I think we've got, to be honest, a long way to go before we develop a condom that is more fun than no condom in many sexual acts. But having said that, we have proven in many, many countries that we can effectively increase condom use in the most risky of sexual activities, and I think we just need to keep working on it.
We just have about a minute. We have a question from someone who asked this question off the air, and I don't know if there's enough time to deal with it. They seem to be interested in the issue of transmission of HIV through the blood supply. I think maybe not in the United States, but in other places, for China, for example.
China had a big outbreak in the blood supply in Henan province in 1993 and 94. That's now been effectively dealt with. There have been outbreaks in other countries. Very early on in France, there was a famous one. I think that the testing technology has now become so sophisticated that there are very, very, very few countries that I know of that have any real risk through the blood supply. We still do have an issue where we don't have enough storage capacity in the blood supply, and so people bring in, if they have an accident, they bring in relatives to donate blood on the spot, and sometimes it's difficult to test that. But in general, the blood supply in most countries, even in developing countries, is now really quite safe.
Well, there we're going to have to stop. If you'd like to read more of our guest's work, you look for her book, The Wisdom of Whores, Bureaucrats, Brothels, and the Business of AIDS. Elizabeth Pisani is her name, P-I-S-A-N-I, has a Ph.D. in infectious disease epidemiology. She's a journalist. She's also done research, analysis, and policy advice for the UN, the World Health Organization, the World Bank, the CDC. And also she has a blog. You might want to take a look at that. That's wisdomofwhores.com. And Dr. Pisani, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.